Tommy McNeil. Venezuela Supreme Court barred opposition leader Juan Guaido from leaving the country Tuesday as the man challenging President Nicolas Maduro claims to the presidency presses forward with establishing a transitional government. That order came down hours after Chief Prosecutor Tarek William Saab announced he was opening a criminal investigation into Guaido's anti-government activities and requested that his financial assets be frozen. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton issued a warning to the Maduro government earlier, urging them not to harm Guaido, who has been recognized by the Trump administration and 24 other nations as Venezuela's rightful president. Opposition envoy Carlos Vecchio says the international community needs to ramp up pressure on the socialist government.
We want to call for a free and transparent election as soon as possible. And that's why we are asking for the support of the international community.
Vecchio met with Vice President Mike Pence at the White House Tuesday. On Monday, the U.S. hit Venezuela's state-owned oil company with economic sanctions. The U.S. State Department, meanwhile, said Americans should not travel to Venezuela, warning of unrest, the threat of being arbitrarily arrested, and the danger of sudden mass demonstrations. America's spy agencies are casting doubt on President Trump's goal of a North Korea free of nuclear weapons, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
National Intelligence Chief Dan Coats says while Kim Jong-un has shown support for ridding the peninsula of nuclear weapons,
we currently assess that North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities.
Telling a Senate panel, Kim sees that as vital to his regime's survival. Coates says the intelligence community also expects Russia and others to take another run at influencing next year's presidential election using new tactics. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And this is VOA News. European Union leaders have ruled out British Prime Minister Theresa May's attempt to renegotiate the terms of Britain's exit from the bloc in March. The British Parliament Tuesday approved May's request to the EU to rework the Irish border provision of the current Brexit deal. But the spokesman for European Council President Donald Tusk immediately ruled out any renegotiation. Britain's House of Commons rejected May's Brexit plans 2 weeks ago, primarily because of the Irish border provision known as the backstop. The backstop would keep Britain in a customs union with the EU in order to keep a free flow of goods between Ireland, an EU member, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. Authorities in Pakistan say a suicide militant raid against a police facility Tuesday in a southwestern area left at least 9 dead, 21 injured. A military statement said 3 bombers carrying guns assaulted a Deputy Inspector General Police Office compound when about 800 candidates were inside for enrollment. The outlawed extremist Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. U.S. President Donald Trump's longtime friend and confidant, Roger Stone, pleaded not guilty to felony charges in the Russia investigation Tuesday. This followed publicity-filled days slamming the probe as politically motivated. The political operative faces charges that he lied to lawmakers, engaged in witness tampering, and obstructed a congressional investigation into possible coordination between Russia and the Trump 2016 presidential campaign. U.S. criminal charges against Chinese electronics giant Huawei have sparked a fresh round of trans-Pacific recriminations, which Beijing demanding Tuesday that Washington back off what it called an unreasonable crackdown on the maker of smartphones and telecom gear. A top Chinese executive facing extradition to the United States appeared in a Canadian court Tuesday to change one of the people who put up bail for her. AP correspondent Jim Morris has more.
Meng Wanzhou's lawyers have added more people to their fence team. They've hired one of the most prestigious law firms in Vancouver to come on board. They've also hired a firm in Toronto to come on board. So you can tell that the family is very wealthy, very powerful. So you can tell they're gearing up for a fight at this end right here.
Meng is scheduled to return to court on March 6th. The deputy mayor of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, says 2 people were killed, 5 wounded Tuesday in an explosion at a gas station. Amatullah said the deputy mayor that the car carried explosives meant to be detonated elsewhere, but it went off prematurely. Mogadishu is often targeted in bombings by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab extremist group. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's opposition leader calls for international intervention in the country's ongoing post-election crisis.
These are clear cases of unleashing of our military on unarmed civilians. And what we need is obviously the intervention of the international community to help us to protect civilians so that there's a restoration of civilian authority in the country.
That's MDC leader Nelson Chamisa. Meanwhile, a ZANU-PF member says what Zimbabwe needs is internal dialogue. A Kenyan court orders five terror suspects to stand trial. Hundreds march in Malawi to condemn violence against women in politics. And the UN seeks almost $1 billion to help Boko Haram victims in northeastern Nigeria.
In total, 1.8 million people are internally displaced in the northeast due to this protracted crisis, which is characterized by massive abuses against civilians, including killings, rape, and burning and pillaging of homes and entire villages.
And Lucky is the spokesman for the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs. Meanwhile, regional leaders are meeting this week in Abuja to address growing insecurity in northeastern Nigeria. And the climate change is linked to Arab Spring mass migration. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe lawyers took to the streets on Tuesday to complain about what they called deteriorating rule of law as the High Court delivered a bail ruling on pastor cum activist Evan Mawarere. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Those are lawyers in Zimbabwe outside the Constitutional Court where they presented a petition to the country's Chief Justice Luke Malawa's office. One of the lawyers is Fadzai Mahere.
Well, the lawyers are marching in support of human rights and restoration of constitutional freedoms, and we don't want the military on the streets or in civilian life or in the courts. It's a march in support of the right to a fair trial.
Among the lawyers' complaints is the refusal by courts to grant bail to more than 1,000 civilians arrested during this month's protests over a fuel hike. They say courts are fast-tracking trials of the protesters before they get all the materials they want to defend themselves. A few protesters, like Pastor Ivan Mawarire, face subversion charges. Mawarire was granted $2,000 bail Tuesday at the High Court. Rights groups have complained that security forces have been brutal in handling the protesters, with cases of rape and assaults flooding the media. But Tuesday, Zimbabwe police spokesperson Cherry Charamba denied charges of widespread abuse.
The law is clear. For each and every offense, there should be redress or a penalty. Hence our passionate appeal to members of the public to report. Reports in some sections of the media that those who have reported are being bullied and labeled are not correct. Only one case of alleged sexual abuse was recorded. Investigations are already in progress. It is not in the culture of the Zimbabwe Republic Police to sweep cases under the carpet.
Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa said President Emmerson Mnangagwa's administration had not taken reports of human rights abuses by the security forces seriously.
So apart from our raising of this issue with SADC, we also want this matter to be addressed in the context of the international community helping us. These are clear cases of unleashing of our military on unarmed civilians. Citizens are defenseless, and what we need is obviously the intervention of the international community to help us in any manner possible to protect civilians so that there's a restoration of civilian authority in the country.
Rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have asked Mnangagwa to order soldiers back to barracks. They have been assisting police maintain law and order since the protest turned violent 2 weeks ago. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
A member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF here in the United States says what Zimbabwe needs is for both the government and the opposition to come together and discuss ways to resolve the country's political and economic crises. This comes after Nelson Chamisa, leader of the opposition movement for democratic change on Tuesday, called for international intervention to find solutions to the country's ongoing post-election crisis. But Frank Guni, chair of the ZANU-PF branch on the east coast of the United States, says the opposition is jumping the gun. He says if the Zimbabwe crisis will ever require any international intervention, it should first be handled by the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and then the African Union.
The Zimbabwean situation, admittedly, we have had some issues and some serious troubles in the past few weeks, but I don't think the political situation in Zimbabwe has gotten so bad that we require an envoy either from the SADC, which is the local region, let alone the African Union. You see, Africa is divided into regions, and the first port of call, if Zimbabweans want external intervention, is the SADC region, the Southern African Development Community. So if the MDC or any other Zimbabweans feel like their government is not listening to what they are saying and they have issues they want resolved by external bodies, the first port of call is SADC, because the African Union does not intervene in regional subterranes without an official invite from the regional groupings. The ruling party and the government have already called for dialogue with the opposition and all Zimbabweans to come to the negotiating table so that we all together come up with solutions to resolve the current crisis in Zimbabwe.
I think it was just this week that the opposition leader in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance leader, Mr. Maimane, asked for the intervention of the African Union and even the United Nations.
Correct.
So are you in favor of that?
No, absolutely not. I think Musa Maimane and his opposition party, Democratic Alliance in South Africa, are just getting overexcited. For starters, the opposition in South Africa has no mandate to call for an intervention by the African Union, let alone in their own country. They cannot even do that. The African Union is a union of member states. Only member states can call for intervention of the African Union. We believe that dialogue will lead us to a lasting solution. And the problems in Zimbabwe can only be solved by Zimbabweans.
I think the issue is one of trust, because the opposition MDC doesn't seem to trust the ruling party.
Well, whether they trust the ruling party or not, that's neither here nor there. At the end of the day, we still have to sit down. It's just like in any family. People don't agree about everything every day. But if there are disagreements or if there are issues that arise in any setting, the best solution is for people to sit down. Bringing external intervention without exhausting local remedies would not help either.
Frank Guni is a chair of the ZANU-PF branch on the east coast of the United States. He spoke with me in our Washington studio. A judge in Kenya has ordered four people to stand trial for their role in the April 2015 Al-Shabaab attack on Garissa University College. But High Court Judge Francis Andayi Tuesday acquitted one other accused for lack of evidence. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The four, Rashid Mberesero, a Tanzanian, Sahal Hussein, Hassan Eden Hassan, and Mohamed Abdi, are accused of masterminding the 2015 Garissa University attack that left more than 140 people dead, majority of them being students. High Court Judge Francis Andayi charged the four with committing a terrorist act, conspiracy to commit a terrorist act, and being members of a terror group.
The accused persons are charged with a total of 156 counts. The charges arise out of events that occurred at the Garissa University College in Garissa County, and the events occurred from the morning of 2nd April 2015 at around 5:30 a.m. to 3rd April 2015. And the fifth accused person is charged alone of being a Tanzanian and being unlawfully present in Kenya.
The four, however, denied the 156 counts they were accused of. Justice Andayi also acquitted accused person Osman Abde, who was working at the university as a guard when the terrorists stormed the campus, for lack of enough evidence.
I find that the fourth accused person, Osman Abdi Dagane, has no case to answer on any of the counts. The prosecution alleged that he was taking photographs of the scene, so there was no evidence adduced to support the allegation that the fourth accused person was taking photographs. So Osman Abdi Dagane is therefore acquitted of all the counts under Section 210 of the Criminal Procedure Code.
At the same time, a court in Kwale County in the coastal region has ruled that the Dusit D217 suspects be remanded for one more week as the police continues with their investigations. The suspect's lawyer said his clients were innocent and that detaining them will not make any difference.
Even if you detain this suspect for the maximum number provided in law, he will not be able and he has no capacity to provide this information.
Yesterday, Tuesday, the police arrested two Al-Shabaab suspects at the Dadaab refugee camp entering the country legally. 2 weeks ago and 24 hours after, a court acquitted one of the Al-Shabaab suspects in the 2013 Westgate Mall terror attack, and another attack was carried out, leaving 21 people dead. The militants have sustained their assault on Kenya, claiming in some instances that their attacks are a retribution for the presence of Kenyan soldiers in Somalia. President Uhuru Kenyatta has said several times that Kenyan troops deployed in Somalia since 2011 will leave only after their mission is achieved. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today is Wednesday, January 30th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The United Nations is seeking almost $1 billion to help Boko Haram victims in northeastern Nigeria. Lisa Schlein reports.
The bulk of the appeal, $848 million, will assist 6.2 million vulnerable people in Nigeria's northeastern Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states. They've been the hardest hit by the decade-long crisis between Boko Haram and Nigeria's government forces. Boko Haram, which wants to set up its own Islamic state based on Sharia law, reportedly has killed more than 20,000 people and forced more than 2 million to flee their homes since the insurgency began in 2009. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says a recent upsurge in violence has displaced more than 80,000 civilians who have sought refuge in crowded camps or in towns in Borno State.
In total, 1.8 million people are internally displaced in the Northeast due to this protracted crisis, which is characterized by massive abuses against civilians, including killings, rape, abduction, child recruitment, and burning and pillaging of homes and entire villages.
Food aid accounts for nearly one-third of the appeal. Money also will be used to provide special treatment for some 370,000 severely acutely malnourished children for nutrition, health, water, and sanitation projects, among others. The UN Refugee Agency and UN Development Program are launching Nigeria's Refugee Response Plan. The agencies are appealing for $135 million to assist more than 250,000 Nigerian refugees displaced by the worsening Boko Haram insurgency in the Lake Chad Basin region. The appeal will assist Nigerian refugees in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Beyond supporting those forced to flee, money also will help the communities hosting the refugees as they themselves are living below the poverty line and are in dire need of aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Regional leaders are meeting in Abuja this week to address growing insecurity for residents in northeastern Nigeria who are fleeing Boko Haram attacks and arriving in neighboring countries in the Lake Chad region. United Nations Refugee Agency's West Africa regional head, Liz Ahua, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the worsening situation and what governments and humanitarian agencies need to do.
The situation has not improved. In fact, it has deteriorated even up to yesterday. People are running. And so we came back to remind the governments of the engagement and to insist that they must recommit themselves to working harder to meet the needs, the protection needs of the so many people that are in the Lake Chad Basin needing this support.
Why do you think the situation has not only not improved but gotten worse?
The situation has not improved. It improved for a time. The four governments were working well together. But focusing mainly on the military aspects of this crisis. In the last 3 months of the year, including this January, there are already more than 300,000 people that have been displaced in Borno State. And as we talk, we have more than 12,000 people who have suffered the ninth attack of their village. And the military forces withdrew and have left them. These people have already fled across some of the villages and the lake to start looking for succor in Cameroon.
Did you say the ninth, as in one less than 10?
That was the ninth attack on one village called Ran in Nigeria. Those people who were already living in very constrained circumstances, where they couldn't go to their farms, where they were constrained in a camp situation, today they have broken camp again and are on the run.
Why are the security forces, why are the regional actors not able to protect these people? What are the big challenges?
Big challenges from our understanding is that Boko Haram has adopted additional tactics. And Boko Haram, as you know, in the last few months has attacked and taken over some military garrisons. It's not all through Nigeria, I must say this. It was not all through Northeast. We're talking of certain localities that are more vulnerable.
And what is UNHCR calling for as a solution?
There are a variety of actions that need to be taken by different people. First of all, you have the government in the four regions that must recommit to protecting their population. We're talking of internally displaced people in Nigeria as well as in the four countries, in the other three countries. So there has to be a recommitment. The four governments have to find of dealing with the Boko Haram actors. On our side, the humanitarian community, we have to ensure that we're passing out information to the displaced people, not just having conferences in the hotels, such as this one, but ensuring that the population knows their rights. And from that knowledge, they should be in a position to react with more certainty rather than ignorance. Then we have to also continue to provide a means of livelihood for them.
That was Liz Ahua, representative for the United Nations Refugee Agency's West Africa Bureau. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Abuja, Nigeria. Hundreds of gender activists and female politicians took to the streets yesterday in Malawi's capital to march against political violence towards women. This came after a female supporter wearing the colors of Vice President Saulos Chilima's United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, was undressed in public by people suspected to be supporters of the ruling Democratic People's Party. Billy Banda is executive director of Malawi Watch, a human rights organization. He says the protesters presented petitions to President Peter Mutharika and the police demanding an immediate end to violence against women in politics.
Tuesday's march was more like a reaction by the women rights NGO alongside many other civil rights organizations that felt it appropriate to support the agenda of the women, considering that it wasn't proper that some disgruntled individuals who are parading to be political functionaries that can actually degrade and actually behave rudely and badly over women, and the fact that women deserve to be given their dignified recognition but also support and protection.
This is political season in Malawi because the country is going to an election soon. How prevalent is this violence against women? I mean, what are some of the examples that you can share with us?
What happened in Mangochi in the lecture district is uncalled for, but also it appears is quite common because it does occur in different places, in different areas. So the purpose of the march was to rise up to the occasion that each and every political party, each and every political leader, each and every person who is calling him or herself leader must not condemn such kind of atrocities or such kind of violence. And which is why we had to take such kind of a march. And the march was simply to tell them that we'll never condone and we'll stand up against such kind of atrocities and will never allow this issue to be created and to continue.
You mentioned the case of Veronica, who was undressed publicly, but also I was reading about Patricia Cagliati. Could you explain, for the purpose of our listeners, the cases of these two women?
Well, I think you're talking about Veronica, who was recently attacked. That is the issue that has drawn the attention of various women folks across the country, including many, many civil society, NGOs, different quarters, including traditional leaders, various court religious leaders, and different quarters of the society. They have felt too aggrieved with what happened last week, recently, in the Lakeshore area of Mangochi. Veronica, the way she was being assaulted and even undressed and the way she has been degraded, we thought it wasn't appropriate.
Billy Banda is executive director of Malawi Watch, a human rights organization. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The mass migration flows that followed the Arab Spring in North Africa and the Middle East were partly caused by climate change, according to new research. Scientists from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria say that in certain circumstances, climate conditions can lead to conflict, which drives increased migration. Henry Richwell reports.
As the Arab Spring uprisings took hold across the Middle East and North Africa in 2010, millions of people fled their homes to find new lives in the years that followed. Researchers claim to have identified evidence of a causal link between those conflicts and changes to the climate across the region and the ensuing migration flows. The report authors, including Raya Mutarak of the University of East Anglia, say the roots of the Syrian conflict can be found in preceding droughts and water shortages. She spoke with VOA.
People started not being able to produce agriculture production, and that was the start of migration from the rural area to urban area, which was already quite crowded. And the resources in the urban area was also scarce. So when there was a kind of tension of fighting for limited resource, and on top is the ethnic polarization in Syria. So it's sort of all that combination.
The researchers used data on asylum applications and conflict-related deaths. They combined this into a mathematical model with data on drought and rainfall, plus other variables such as population size and measures of democracy and ethnic diversity. Again, Raya Mutarak.
So let's look how climate increases the probability of conflict. And once we estimate that, we use the number that we got from that to estimate the next step. So the country that experienced conflict from climate variation, are they likely to send out the refugee flows or not?
The researchers emphasize that climate change will not cause conflict and subsequent asylum-seeking flows in every instance.
The effect of climate on migration through conflict is quite specific to certain time period and to certain countries. So climate-induced conflict, it's a bit more likely in the country with the medium level of democracy.
The results of this study are specific to the Western Asia region and the time period in question. But it's hoped the research will contribute to the global debate on how migration flows will be affected by increasingly severe climate change. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Hundreds of gender activists and female politicians took to the streets yesterday in Malawi's capital to march against political violence towards women. This came after a female supporter wearing the colors of Vice President Salos Chilima's United Transformation Movement UTM party was undressed in public by people suspected to be supporters of the ruling Democratic People's Party. And that is it for this Wednesday, January 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Please join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and enlighten us all on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1700 hours UTC on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.